Acts chapter 23 this evening, and while you're finding your way there, great to always acknowledge this family. We have a missionary family visiting with us tonight, and so Mike and Teresa Howard, along with Sabrina, Seth, and Sophia. So if you would stand for me, that would be great. Please be seated. We're always glad that you somehow are able to fit us in this big state of California and come our way. It's always a blessing and a joy. Maybe you're here tonight and you have never met a missionary, not face to face, and here they are. God brought them all the way from Harrogate, England, and Michael pastors a church there, Calvary Chapel. They're also reaching the city of Leeds, which is about 40 minutes away, involved in coming alongside Calvary Chapels in Nigeria, very significant work in teaching pastors and leaders. And so they're going to have a table set up after the service out in the fellowship hall where you can greet them and hug a missionary and find out a little bit more about their missionary work this evening. Let me get my stopwatch going here. It means nothing, but at least lets me know how long I'm going over. So, when we come to chapter 23, separated from it now for a couple of weeks, just a brief review related to it. The Apostle Paul finds himself in a very, very difficult place in his Christian service, and God has an extraordinary word of encouragement to him in the passage. The only person on that scene that is undergoing difficulty that doesn't approach the Apostle Paul's, but certainly is very significant, is a Roman commander by the name of Lysias. And the passage is a record here of an attempt by Lysias to discover the cause of a riot that occurred on the Jewish temple when Paul, making his way at the conclusion of his third missionary journey, comes to Jerusalem with an offering from the Gentile churches and with a desire to preach the gospel, preach Christ to the Jews there in Jerusalem. He comes at the time of the Jewish feast of Pentecost, and during that time there, during the feast, he is accused by the Jews in the area of the temple of having brought in Gentile up into that section of the temple that was only supposed to be entered by the Jews. And as a result of this, nothing could be further from the truth, but they very, very nearly beat him to death. Lysias rescues him with considerable effort from being beaten to death. He begins to lead Paul to a place of safety. Paul sees the opportunity to preach to his Jewish brethren, which has been in the back of his heart and mind, or the front of his heart and mind, for so long, slipping away from him. And then he asks Lysias if he might have an opportunity before he slipped off into Roman custody, then to speak to his brethren. Lysias allows him to speak to his brethren in the hopes that he might be able to discover what in the world created this riot, which was a very dangerous thing in Jerusalem under the Roman rule. He gives Paul permission to speak to the crowd, and Paul, rather than engaging in a back and forth with them, "You said I brought a Gentile up here, I didn't bring a Gentile up here, yeah, well, we thought in this," no, it doesn't go anywhere there. And instead, Paul gets up and he begins to give his testimony to these Jewish people about how he had encountered Jesus Christ. And the testimony in his sermon is going fabulous, until the word Gentile comes out of his mouth, intimating that God has had and has as great an interest in saving the Gentile world as the Jewish world. And then all bets are off. It goes into a chaos again and into a riot, and Lysias is no closer to understanding what's at the core of any of this. If he's a Roman official, if he's going to arrest somebody, there has to be charges. And so he still has no charges related to this. So he takes Paul in back and then orders Paul to be beaten, to be examined by scourging. Paul says to the man that's about to administer the scourging, I'm a Roman citizen. And everybody knew, not only did you not scourge a Roman citizen, you did not falsely imprison a Roman citizen. He lets Lysias know once again. Lysias is frantic again. He's over his position and handling the situation properly. Now, this has been denied him as a means of finding out what is going on here through the apostle Paul. And so on the following day, Lysias continues his quest for understanding the cause of the riot and the commotion on the part of the priests and on the part of the Jewish religious community and on the Temple Mount area. And so he commanded the chief priests and their council to appear. The Jewish Sanhedrin or Sanhedrin to come and make known their charges on the following day against the Apostle Paul, and then to hear Paul's defense against those charges. So this is Lysias still trying to get an understanding of what he's in the middle of. And all of that is there encapsulated to some degree or another in verse 30 of chapter 22. And the next day, because he, that is Lysias, wanted to know for certain, which he needed to do as a Roman official, why Paul was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds. He commanded the chief priests, all their council, to appear and brought Paul down and now set him before them. And so Paul is placed in the midst of them. And so you can kind of picture all of this in your mind. There's some prearranged meeting place where you have the Jewish Sanhedrin present. Paul is present. There is a Roman military presence also as a part of that courtroom. The Jewish council, known as the Sanhedrin, was the 71 most powerful men in Judaism at any one point in time and in all of the world. And so it was then. And so the great ruling body among the Jews, they were considered to be the experts on the law of Moses and the administering of the law. Lysias, because he arranges the meeting here, the meeting was not in the normal meeting place for the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin met typically in their official place of meeting that was known as the Chamber of Hewn Stones, but because that sat on the Jews' only side of the temple grounds, then Lysias and his soldiers would not have been allowed. So it was some other kind of a location that Lysias had arranged. And so here's this scene, and the floor is evidently turned over to Paul, chapter 23, verse 1. And then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, can you see him there in that scene? And then he said to them, men and brethren, so he's not intimidated by the scene at all. He speaks to the Sanhedrin as peers, as brothers, men and brethren. A considerable argument can be made in looking at the scriptures that it was highly likely that before Paul became a Christian, that he was actually a member of the Sanhedrin. And that his Christianity ended up disqualifying him from that. And so he's very familiar with the scene, very familiar with the authority and the situation. Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And so he declared to them as he stood before them, he declared that his conscience did not condemn him in any way before God, much less before the Sanhedrin. He said, if my conscience is clean about anything that I have done here, then I ought to be clean and clear of any guilt in your eyes. And he declares himself innocent, his opening a statement here, as the floor is given to him. All of his life he had endeavored, he said, to please and to obey God. And concerning the immediate circumstances that had led to his arrest and his standing before them on trial. In other words, whatever you might think of me or whatever charges you bring against me in this hearing, I know I am right with God. And so he declares himself not only to be innocent before them, but before God. When you're in a situation like that, it's amazing in all of the intimidation of that environment and the soberness of that environment, it's amazing the kind of boldness we can have. It's a Christ-like boldness when we know we're right with God. And when we know we're right with God, it doesn't matter who is against us. Doesn't matter if it's the 71 most powerful Jewish leaders in all of Judaism 2,000 years ago. If I know that I'm right with God, we can stand. And that's why when situations occur within our lives, they're massive. The situation is intimidating. It's not an everyday environment for us. Might be being falsely accused the way that the Apostle Paul is, or some other set of circumstances. And we go to God before we end up in this environment and we say, God, I am able to, by your grace, but able to endure this situation as long as I know I'm right with you. Am I right with you? And Paul knew his conscience was clear. I'm right with God. And so the intimidation of the environment, the strength that he feels there in that situation, there's another audience that is there beyond the Sanhedrin, and that's God himself. And he declares himself to be innocent. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. To be able to know we are innocent of whatever charge is being brought against us, and God knows it even if nobody else knows it. Well, he'd hardly gotten these words out of his mouth, verse 2, then the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him there, and obviously kind of Jewish security there in this meeting, he commanded those who stood by Paul to strike him on the mouth. And so he declares that, strike this man on the mouth for declaring this very thing, that he is right with God in the presence of this environment. So here you have the high priest Ananias. He understands exactly what Paul is saying here. I'm right with God. And I know I'm right with God. And the only way you're going to be right with God is if you deal with this properly and you admit what is true, I'm saying is true about myself, is also true. And so here's this declaration Paul makes, that he was a good Jew despite being a Christian, not responsible at all for the riot in the temple, and that the blame lay solely upon the religious Jews. God was pleased with him. It angered the high priest and again struck a nerve. He understood exactly what Paul was doing. Now, for a Jew to be tried before the Sanhedrin and to be smitten physically smitten in that environment was contrary, completely contrary, to the law of Moses. And Paul's going to let them know that in no uncertain terms. Now, Ananias is described by the Jewish historian Josephus as one of the worst high priests of that era, known for his arrogance, quick temper, extreme cruelty toward people, and most of all, for his greed. So he does nothing in this scene except to confirm Josephus's assessment of him. This is how he treated everybody. It would be bad enough if he was Joe Schmo from Kokomo, but he holds the highest position within Judaism in claiming to represent the God of the Bible and conducting himself in this way and having this kind of character. And Paul's response was immediate. Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Some of you say, well, that's in the Bible. I could use that at times like this and be okay. He said, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law of Moses, and then you command me to be struck contrary to the law? And Paul appears, and wouldn't be a surprise to us, Paul has a short fuse and an intolerance for hypocrisy. He has a very high view of God. He has a very high view of the Word of God. And when this is done in misrepresenting both God and the law of Moses, in a righteous anger, he rebukes the person. He rebukes the high priest. Now, he clearly, as we'll see in a moment, he does not recognize the person who gave the order as being the high priest at this point. And some speculate, and it's not bad speculation, that Paul, on one of his missionary journeys, had picked up an eye infection, and that he spoke to the Galatians about, you would have pulled out your own eyes, you know, to help me, and all of this, a disease that was common in the ancient world. And so maybe he couldn't see very far in the room to where this person was and recognize him to be the high priest. Or he might just be a slightly older man with eye problems long before eyeglasses. You think about what some of us would be able to see or not see if it weren't for eyeglasses. Some of us a little later in life. Some of us, it's 6 years old. So you take the glasses away and we don't have any idea what might be happening in the room. We don't know if we're in a can of worms or these are people moving around in the room. We just know there's movement going on. And so he declares Paul there. Paul does declares him to be a whitewashed tomb. And in this, he's declaring the high priest to be a hypocrite, giving the appearance of being something white and holy on the outside and yet completely corrupt on the inside. And that's what a tomb was. And under the law of Moses, if you, as a Jew, were to come into contact inadvertently, you walk through some kind of a place, a cave or something, a body was buried, and there's some kind of a stone or something related to marking this as a grave. You didn't see the stone, and so you stepped upon the grave. That would render you ceremonially unclean to come into contact with death and the corruption of death. It was a way of reminding them of the corruption of death, the unnaturalness of death. God never intended us to die. That was introduced into the human condition in the Garden of Eden. And so they would whitewash the tombs or the stones so a Jew could see them ahead of time and then miss being defiled. And so a tomb was something that was filled with a body that was now corrupted. And you whitewashed it, and the whitewashing was kind of in contrast to what was under the ground or in the cave. And so he says, you have the appearance, all of the robes, all of the everything that you're wearing there, and you have the appearance of being something that's holy and something that is right, but every contact with you is someone who would deal with the law of Moses in this way, every contact with you defiles anyone that comes into contact with you. It's quite a charge. And it was very true of him. And so Paul confronted his hypocrisy. Jesus rebuked the Pharisees and the Jewish religious leaders in his day in the same way. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're like whitewashed tombs which appear beautiful outwardly, but inside you're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. And even so, you outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. And because and I don't know that maybe Paul was aware of that teaching related to Jesus, and this comes to his mind as he brings it forth, but this is what he recognized immediately. His mind thinks in terms of Scripture. His mind thinks in terms of what does the Bible say about this. And he realizes that anybody that would do this in this city claiming to represent God is a whitewashed tomb. Appears to be one thing, but is corrupt inside. And so this is the response that he gives there. And it's a righteous anger. Then those who stood by, they said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" So they're shocked. Nobody talked to the Sanhedrin this way. And nobody talked to the high priest this way. And so he's informed, "Do you revile God's high priest?" And what a sting there must be to God's high priest. They all knew he was corrupt as the day was long. And they confronted him for reviling the high priest. And then just as quickly, there in verse 5, as Paul had this flash of righteous anger, very quick to admit his mistake and for what he had said to the high priest. And he said, "I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest." And again, Paul, in his mind, it would be inconceivable that a high priest would have been one to give that order. And yet that's exactly what happened. He said, "I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written," and now he quotes from the book of Leviticus, the law of Moses, concerning attitude toward authority, God-given authority, "You shall not speak of evil of a ruler of your people." And so Paul explains he didn't realize that he had rebuked the high priest. And he quotes, I said Leviticus, but it's Exodus 22:28. And Paul really models something for us here as Christians that is being very rapidly lost in our culture, degraded in a massive way, even within my lifetime. And here the Apostle Paul, he recognizes and he honors the office of the high priest, even when he couldn't honor the person who filled the office at the moment. And we may not like the various people then elected office, but as such, they are in that position as a part of a divine ordinance of government and God's institution of that, and a level of respect is to be shown them for the office that they hold. We can disagree with them, we can seek their defeat in the next election, but we're to show a level of respect while we're doing so. And we're to be distinct in how we view government and how we view those that fill those positions as Christians, distinct from the rest of the world. And so the same thing is true really in all levels of government and positions. Same thing is true of law enforcement, or school teachers, or our supervisors at work, and these kind of things. It doesn't mean that we can't hold them responsible if necessary for wrongdoing, but even in doing that, we're to be civil related to that. And so the office is to be respected. The authority structure is to be respected. The institution, God-given institution of government, is to be respected. And because if this loss of respect for authority within these positions, once that loss of respect crosses a line, then we become vulnerable to something that is far more dangerous than the nincompoop who happens to fill that position at the moment in our lives for a time, and that is for a complete collapse of respect for authority within a culture. And now you have anarchy within a culture, and you have riots, and you have mob rule. And so here is this important thing in our culture. I don't need to tell you, we live in a country that is divided right down the middle. Are we going to get a revival that turns it in the right direction? Or is it going to continue in its slide and mean that the Lord's return is that much closer? I don't know. I pray for revival. I pray for the Lord's return. I've got tickets on both flights. And so I'm set on it. But it's dangerous what is happening here today in our nation, and important to give that some thought. The New Testament parallel here is Romans chapter 13, verse 7. Give to everyone what you owe him. Pay your taxes and government fees to those who collect them, and give respect and honor to those who are in authority. And so the Apostle Paul, he had already written this, and so he knew what was to be not only an Old Testament view of authority, but a New Testament view of authority to properly represent God. And so he acknowledged the protection that the law of Moses gave to the high priest. And so Paul gets rebuked here. That can kind of hurt your momentum out of the gates if you're going to give an address. Paul realizes that it was a mistake, that he apologizes for, and he makes it right. And then we're told he continues with his defense here. He said, but when Paul perceived, Luke does, that one part of the Sanhedrin here in this hearing were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I'm being judged. And so here, the Apostle Paul, to understand what's going on here, the Sadducees were one major sect of Judaism at the time. Pharisees were also. The Sadducees were the rationalists of their day. They didn't believe in resurrection. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in miracles. They had serious doubts about even life after death, despite the teaching of the Old Testament. The Pharisees were clearly on the other end of the spectrum. They believed in resurrection. They believed in life after death. They believed in miracles. They believed in God speaking to people in spiritual gifts. So Paul realizes there's a divide here. And Paul came, before he became a Christian, he came out from the ranks of the Pharisees. The group that did believe in resurrection and in the supernatural and in all of the things that Paul had declared true when he gave his testimony of the fact that Jesus spoke to him following his salvation and gave him orders to take the gospel also to the Gentiles, and that a very resurrected Jesus had done that. And so the Pharisees would listen to that statement by Paul in one way, and the Sadducees would have heard that testimony of Paul's in a completely different way. And so he declares all of this concerning himself and the charges being brought against him, why he's being judged in this way. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Oh, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so he's got them now at one another's throats. And the assembly was divided. They didn't know what to do now with Paul. They're so busy fighting over one another and the views of resurrection that they'd lost sight of Paul. For the Sadducees say that there's no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose. They protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man. And if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." And so this entire side of the Sanhedrin becomes his defense attorneys. And now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, poor Lysias, he fears now that Paul's going to be torn into pieces by them in that hearing that he's supervising. He commanded the soldiers to go down and take Paul by force and from among them and bring him up into the barracks. So poor Lysias, see, he's either 0 for 3 or 0 for 4 at this point, and trying to figure out what in the world he's in the middle of. Now, you got to give this guy a lot of credit. And he's loyal to Rome in this way. Justice was a serious issue to the Romans. And justice couldn't be meted out without knowing the facts and establishing the facts. And that's what he's trying to do here. And I mean, he can almost put us to shame sometimes. His unwillingness to believe anything about anything until he can establish the facts. And he works very, very hard to do that. Now, in terms of Paul's motive for blowing up the meeting in this way, there's different motives are ascribed to him. Some people view this as just kind of a clever tactic by Paul that he, in order to divide the council and divert attention away from himself. So practically speaking, he realizes, I'm not going to get a fair hearing at all. In this setting, so I'm just going to turn the whole trial up on its head, and he realized the quickest way to blow this whole thing up is to head into some kind of a division between the Sadducees and the Pharisees and get them to begin fighting with one another over the issue of the doctrine of resurrection. And if that was the case, it was very successful, because the whole thing did degenerate into a great dissension between the two groups, again becoming violent enough that Paul had to be rescued from the settings and taken by force back into Roman barracks. And so I believe, though, related to all of this, that at this point in the trial, Paul did decide to move the focus of the trial off of himself and to instead put it on something biblical, just like he had done when he spoke to the Jews in the area of the temple just a day or so earlier, had a chance to establish his innocence before the Jewish people against the charges being made against him. And he thought to himself, what a perfect waste of an opportunity to preach the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ to this group, and how he longed to do that to the Jewish people. And I think it's the same heart that he has in this setting, and he takes the trial and he focuses it on something biblical, on resurrection, and I'm convinced that he had every intention then of preaching Jesus, his death, his burial, his resurrection as an evidence of the truth of his claims to be the Jewish Messiah based upon the Old Testament scriptures. And this was the very kind of sermon that he had preached all day, every day during his three missionary journeys. It was something he was familiar with. It was just a way to get the subject turned to Jesus in front of this audience. But before he can continue his apologetic here, the two groups begin to fight over the issue of resurrection. And I think that Paul identified himself here as a Pharisee because the two groups, of those two groups, that was the group he was going to try and his best attempt at preaching Jesus as the Messiah to them. The Sadducees, because of their very bizarre and unbiblical beliefs, were five steps behind the Pharisees in terms of trying to deal with them biblically for recognizing Jesus to be the Messiah. But at any rate, this is what occurs. He's taken out of that setting, now brought back into the barracks. And the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must bear witness at Rome." You put yourself in Paul's shoes at this point. I mean, his trip to Jerusalem, all the plans that he had for it or might have had for it, and all of it lays in a heap right now before him. He comes there to try and build bridges with the Jewish community, the people that he wanted to reach with the gospel and to recognize Christ as the Messiah. All of these efforts have been rebuffed, violently rebuffed on his part. He had spent missionary journeys gathering an offering among the Gentile churches to bring to the Christian church in Jerusalem in their hardship in order to build bridges between the Jewish group that makes up the body of Christ and the Gentile group. And with all of the commotion that's occurred, there's not even a mention related to the offerings. This great endeavor of his has amounted to nothing. Luke doesn't even record for us whatever became of the offering, and that's how quickly it slipped into insignificant. And here is this trip where everyone had been warning him all along, don't go, chains, imprisonment are going to await you there, tribulation. And he'd been warned away, and instead he had come anyway, and all of those things had happened. And so if you put yourself in Paul's shoes, you might imagine that you would be in a desperate need of a word from God for perspective, and for God's perspective about what has just happened in Jerusalem. And God, what do I do now? I know we've all been in situations where we think something's going to go a certain way, and then it doesn't. And then it really doesn't. And we have so oriented our heart, our mind, our soul, our strength toward it turning out a certain way. And when something blows up on the level that this blows up, it can be disorienting to us. I thought I heard, I thought this would turn, I thought that maybe and all this kind of stuff. And when something like that happens, we need a word from God. And God gave it to him. Jesus himself did. When somebody's in a, and I mentioned every so often, and somebody's in a really, really deep trial, and it's true about our own lives, when we're in an immense difficulty on the level of what Paul is in here, we are grateful for the encouragement that people give to us. We're grateful for all of that, and it's important. But there's a certain place where circumstances go that the only thing that can sustain us is to have a word from God. God, how do you see this? I must hear from you. Give me a verse. Bring something to my remembrance, a spiritual gift, something that you want to communicate, word of wisdom, word of knowledge, prophecy. I must hear from you in this situation. Nothing that one person or 10 people or 100 people could say to me can get me through what I'm going through here. And sometimes I pray with people in the middle of an awful, awful mess in their lives. And I'll pray something like that. God, thank you for the people that bring encouragement. But this brother and this sister here needs to hear something from you that they recognize. Maybe it's delivered to them through someone, but they'll recognize in the deliverance of it, this is God's word concerning my situation. And then it becomes clear what's happening here. and what that encouragement and that perspective means to us, and nothing else can take its place at times like that, and certainly not in Christian service. And so here in the middle of all of this chaos of the day or a couple days prior, and Jesus stood by Paul, and it's, I don't think you can improve upon the outline of what happens here in this encouragement in verse 11, is that Jesus just simply made him aware of three things. Number one, his presence, and then number two, his pleasure, and number three, his plan. And concerning his presence, he just let Paul know, I'm here. Sometimes when this kind of a trial hits, it feels like God is a million miles away, that he's not close by. And we need that reassurance. I'm right next to you. Lots of verses in the Bible that affirm that within our lives, that we can claim and hold on to. And Paul needed that reminder that the Lord was with him. Sometimes we can feel like he's sleeping, or he's on a vacation, or 100 miles away, you know, a million miles away running the universe, or whatever it might be, and everything but seeing, realizing that, no, he is right here with me. Even though I can't see him, he's not only present, but he's actively present in my life. And then he tells Paul, be of good cheer and take courage. And so here Jesus informs Paul of his pleasure. So why would the Lord tell him to be of good cheer, except this really has Paul down. It's really affected him, what it is that has happened. And Jesus, and he just encourages him there that be of good cheer. His pleasure with what Paul had done there in Jerusalem, and he told him to take two reasons for encouraging his courage and letting him know, you've testified for me in Jerusalem. Paul looks like a disaster to you. That's why you're discouraged. It looks like a disaster to you. I'm pleased. I'm happy with it. I'm happy with what you did. I'm happy with what you spoke. I'm happy with how you represented me. I'm happy with what you tried to do among your people. I'm pleased with what happened here. And so often we can think that things have to turn out a certain way. Million people saved, or whatever it might be, and then this is the evidence of God's pleasure. It can be a disaster, and God is happy with it. And he just lets him know that. I'm pleased with what you've done here, Paul. And Jesus didn't want Paul at all to even remotely consider this time in Jerusalem to be a failure. And how people respond to our service to the Lord and our walk with the Lord, and how they behave, Jesus is saying, that's not a reflection on you, Paul. That's a reflection on them. You did great. We have funny ways of determining what's great. In the United States of America, success, you know, it's measured in terms of power and money, and then that can carry over into our ministry lives or attitudes related to the kingdom. It can be a disaster, and God is pleased with it, because we've been faithful, even when our faithfulness produces the disaster. And there's something about knowing, again, in these low spots that occur in our lives and in our service to the Lord and walk with the Lord, to know that as bad as these circumstances are around me, God says it brings him pleasure. What I've done pleases him. And if we know that about these circumstances, it doesn't matter who is against us, up against all of that pleasure of the Lord, and it gets us through an awful lot in life. I just think about how priceless to Paul these words must have been, and how much they are to us as well. And then he lets Paul know his plan. He must also bear witness at Rome. And so here, Jesus revealed his plan to Paul. would have looked very easy for Paul to look at his life and thought everything is spinning out of control. And Jesus says, no, it's all going according to plan. Not your plan, but my plan. You came to Jerusalem and you did exactly what you wanted to do and what I wanted you to do. I'm pleased with all of it, but because it goes sideways doesn't mean that you've exited my plan for your life. And not only, and I have a plan going forward from this. And the very thing that you've done here in Jerusalem, I'm going to have you do in Rome. This is all part of a plan, Paul. And you're right in the middle of my plan. And his fate not in the control of Rome and his enemies, the religious Jews, but his life and his fate completely in control of the Lord. And it's true of all of us. Jesus promised Paul, you're going to bear witness just as you did in Jerusalem. You're going to do the same thing in Rome. I'm sending you to Rome. The Bible talks about a future and a hope. There's something wonderful at a low point in our lives when God speaks about the future. And more than about the future, but about what he has in mind for our lives concerning the future. The hope that that infuses in us. I thought I'd blown up my whole ministry. I thought I'll never recover from what has happened here in Jerusalem. My name is mud. Three missionary journeys and everything that was done here, this will be the asterisk next to my name in the New Testament history. No, it's all part of a plan. And the plan is continuing, Paul, and it'll continue in Rome. And that's why you might wonder when Paul ultimately makes his way to Rome and he stands before the Roman emperor, Paul did not use that, he would not use that opportunity to stand before Caesar in that courtroom as an opportunity, once again, not that he had tried, but once again he would not use it as an opportunity to explain his innocence and to gain his freedom. He would use it to preach Jesus Christ crucified and buried and risen again, because he knew all the way back to this point here in the city of Jerusalem, that's what I'm going to Rome to do and to stand before the emperor to do. Now, as you go into verse 12 here, when it was the next day, following this wonderful night of encouragement, some of the Jews, they banded together and they bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had called Paul. Well, there's a church you want to join. I mean, some of you don't know that we have a men's small group. It's just 40 men are allowed in at a time. And they vow not to eat or drink until they kill various people in the world. Keep it out of the bulletin. You have to be invited to this. Imagine representing God. And this is how off base, how corrupted the priesthood had become at this time. And there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. And they came to the chief priests and the elders. So they come to the Jewish leadership and they said, we've bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we've killed Paul. And the chief priests and the elders say, God forbid, that's a violation of the law of Moses. I can't allow you to do that. Well, we could wish that was the next verse, but that's not what they did. They were then told what their part in the plan was. Now you, therefore, gather with the council, suggest to the commander that he, that is Paul, be brought down to you tomorrow to further interrogate him as though you're going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we are ready to kill him before he comes. This is your part in this plan. And the Jewish religious establishment enters into the agreement. And so when Paul's sister's son Wait a second. It's the only place in the Bible that we read about the Apostle Paul's family. It's all we know about his family. He had a sister and he had a nephew. There's speculations about him being married and so forth. But here's what we do know. And so here's this nephew of his. Nobody seems to know that this is his nephew. He hears about their ambush. And he went and entered into the barracks and he told Paul about it. Paul called for one of the centurions to him and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." And so he took him and brought him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." And the commander took him by the hand, went aside, and talked with him privately. "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But don't yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they've killed Paul. And now they are ready, waiting for that promise from you to give the approval for this meeting." And so when the commander let the young man depart, he commanded him, "Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me." And then Lysias, he called for two centurions each of them over 100 Roman soldiers. And he said, "Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night," 9 o'clock at night. So this is, Paul's going to get an escort to Caesarea, kind of the Roman capital of that province of Rome, and where the Roman governor was. And he's going to send Paul with 470 Roman soldiers, 70 of them on horseback. This gives you an idea of the kind of trouble if a Jewish uprising occurred over Paul, the lengths that the Romans went to not to allow that kind of thing to happen. And so they provided mounts also to set Paul on and bring him then safely to Felix, the governor in Caesarea. And Lysias, he wrote a letter in the following manner to explain to Lysias what it is that was happening here. He didn't really have accusations, the formal accusations against Paul, but he's going to describe why this is being escalated now to Festus's attention. So the letter reads, "Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and about to be killed by them." Okay, so far so good. "Coming with troops, I rescued him." Okay, that's pretty close to the truth. "Having learned that he was a Roman." No, you didn't learn he was a Roman until way after that. "And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. And when it was told me the Jews lie in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell." You see how difficult it is to get the truth in life. And it's always been the case. And we're subjective. We paint ourselves even in the best light, even if it means a fabrication or a moving around of the facts. But in general, it was a fair representation of what had occurred, good enough for Felix to be able to begin to deal with it. And then the soldiers, as they were commanded, they took Paul, brought him that night to Antipatris there in Israel, The next day, they left the horsemen to go on with him. So Paul continues with the 70 horsemen. The 400 soldiers then returned to the barracks. And when they came to Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor, and they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from to make sure that this was under his jurisdiction. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear you when your accusers also have come." And he commanded Paul to be kept in Herod's praetorium. It's one of the, there's so many great aspects to the Christian life, but one of the great blessings and encouragements to our faith as Christians is to see the fingerprints and notice the fingerprints that God leaves all over our lives and our circumstances, to know that he was involved in what just happened. And so you look at this, Paul's nephew happens to be at the right place at the right time. He overhears, nobody knows he's the nephew. He goes and he tells, and then Paul gets safely delivered from this attempt upon his life. After all, God had said he was going to go to Rome, not going to die there in Jerusalem. And so here is this, what is known as the providence of God, or the sovereignty of God, that God rules over all and he overrules all for his purposes within our lives. New Testament, Romans 8:28, and we know that he works all things together for good to those who love God and are the called according to his purposes. And so often we look at circumstances in our life and we say, "Oh, what a lucky break. I thank my lucky stars," you know, or these goofy sayings that people can have. And there's no such thing as luck related to our lives. But so often we can't see until later. It's later we see that's what God was doing right there. And that was a God thing, as people say, related to this situation, and it encourages our faith. There's nothing accidental about our lives. God is present as he was with the Apostle Paul. He is pleased with our lives. Our lives bring him pleasure as we serve him. And he has a plan for our lives. And that plan is unfolding in not all of the Jewish establishment or all of Rome could undo that for the Apostle Paul. And the same thing is true related to our lives. It's a very encouraging passage, especially in our service to the Lord. Let's stand together now and we'll close in prayer. Father, thank you that you know us the way that you do. Thank you that you have grown us into a relationship with you to such a place that when we find ourselves in the places that approach on some level what the Apostle Paul was facing, that the one thing that we need to hear and want to hear is, are we all right with you? Are we still in the middle of your plan? Is that plan still unfolding? Does our life bring you pleasure? And I pray tonight, we pray for one another, for anybody that's sitting in the middle of chaos, that would have them doubting these things related to their lives based upon the circumstances, that you would help them and us to embrace these truths. Thank you that you speak to us. Thank you that you speak to us in all the different ways that you do, and to have you having spoken to us, and that assurance that we are right with you, that assurance that you are at work in our lives despite the difficulty, what hardship that can take us through, has taken us through, and will continue to take us through. Thank you for including this chapter in Paul's life here in the book of Acts, so that it could be an encouragement to us in our walk with you tonight. And we thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.